Hello, and welcome to Shakespeare on Screen, a podcast where I meet up with friends to chat about adaptations of Shakespeare's works for film or TV. And coming back again to close out the York Tetralogy is Alex. Hi, Alex, how are you doing?
Hello, it is a dark and gloomy cold day today. Perfect time to talk about Richard III.
Yes, Richard III. Well, it's a beautiful, gorgeous day where I'm recording from, so I don't know, but we'll figure it out. So, Richard III.
Richard III. Have you, did you come across this play before any of the Henry VI plays?
That is a great question. And the answer is, I never read it in college, and so even though, like, just through cultural osmosis, you hear things like Now is the Winter of Our Discontent, and, like, a little bit of Tudor propaganda, blah, 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 I actually hadn't.
Ah, interesting.
So just being a fan of Game of Thrones led me to reading / audiobooking a bunch of the real life history books, and then, like, okay, let's check out the Shakespeare plays now. And I actually watched them in order, which made approaching Richard III, and part of my central conceit that is a bit of a debate between the two of us, is when you watch the BBC version of Richard III or the Hollow Crown version of Richard III, Richard plays as such a different character, and the events play out so differently compared to watching it in isolation.
Oh, no debate there. That's because that's their intent. But the other two productions we're checking out, the Laurence Olivier and the, I should have gotten the director's name, but what I guess will be called the Ian McKellen version. Mm-hmm. Sorry, director, you didn't do anything else of note. So those two are Richard III in isolation, and they still work as productions. And I just wonder, because I did read, was actually in this play somewhat well before I read or saw any of the other three Henry VI plays. And I don't know, maybe that influences my opinion that they exist in isolation.
Richard Loncrane.
There you go.
And is the director for McKellen's Richard III. Looking through, just not familiar with anything else he's done.
No, I remember checking it out. I have seen
The Special Relationship.
Yeah, that's well-known film.
Yeah, it's very well-known film. It's the last of Michael Sheen's Tony Blair trilogy.
Right.
So it's Tony Blair and his relationship with Bill Clinton. Fun movie, but
yeah, no, I think, and we'll get into all of them, I know, but just the McKellen, which I'm still going to call Richard III, was just right at that height of popularity of everyone's doing Shakespeare adaptations, so whoever wants to do it, just do a Shakespeare adaptation and you're good.
Yeah, actually, hey, that's a fun little theme to jump off and also talk about. I always love trivia, is that now whoever curated the Wikipedia page for Olivier's Richard III is, again, very kind to him, because they don't talk about, there was kind of, I think, by Olivier himself, a bit of a big surge in Shakespeare movies from the 40s into the 50s. You get Olivier's Hamlet, you get his Henry V, and you also get Mankiewicz's Julius Caesar. And so you get a bunch of these big, high-profile Shakespeare adaptations. And what killed the trend then was, sadly, Olivier's Richard III.
Seriously?
It seems like it. Like, Olivier's Richard III was a gigantic bomb when it came out. And it didn't kill Olivier's directing career, the popular myth is that working with Marilyn Monroe broke him from movie directing, and that's certainly the myth that is presented when you watch the My Week with Marilyn movie.
Right.
But that's not entirely true. He was, if you listen to Kirk Douglas's account, he was very open to the idea of directing Spartacus. So he was very much open to the idea of directing again. Like, Marilyn Monroe did not break him, but unfortunately it did break. And you can see in that after Richard III, he chooses to do Prince and the Showgirl, and then later on do The Entertainer. Of that, the plays that he could get funding to make movies on were not Shakespeare plays. And it's the saddest tragedy to me of that, while we do get quite a few more recorded Olivier plays, because it was a flop at the time, it pretty much killed him getting funding for a Shakespeare movie that he would direct. And the biggest tragedy is supposedly his next one on the list was Macbeth, which people say was his best role.
I don't know. I didn't like his Hamlet enough to think that his Macbeth would be very good, but that's a whole other point. I can understand why his Richard III would tank, and I'll lay my cards on the table and say I really like it. However, his is the most adapted and in kind of Olivier fashion, maybe too much. And some of the things I really like about it don't play as well for a quote-unquote layman audience, one who isn't coming in with the background of the play. Unlike, I think, his Henry V is more palatable and really just existed for, you know, pro-war propaganda, and Hamlet is Hamlet. So I can certainly see why his Richard III would be well-received.
Well, here's the flip side. One, okay, he was well-received. It got good reviews even at the time, and he got nominated for Best Actor again for his Richard.
I meant for the general public, why it bombed.
But here's the fun thing, is that pretty much this one was a case of immediately after it was released, it found its audience later on TV. Because it aired in 1966 on TV, and the BFI later claimed, like, the amount of people that saw it on TV, that's where Richard III became a giant hit, and Olivier's Richard III became iconic. And now, it's the BFI. I don't know how much I really believe this, but yeah. BFI credits the film as having done more than anything to popularize Shakespeare.
Sure. You go off, BFI. I don't know if I can accept that one.
they're like, I don't know how much I believe that. That's just like how much anything Shakespeare for the first time being nationally broadcast in the United States. They were like, so many people saw it. Like, this is more than anyone has ever seen a Shakespeare play in history. And okay. I mean, that's true, but I don't know how much that's just, like, there were three networks at the time also, so I don't know.
Fair enough. I think that's, if you want to jump into it, what really strikes me about the Olivier Richard III, one, the way he changes the script, but also his performance of Richard is unique when compared to McKellen, Cook, and Cumberbatch, because most people who play Richard go for the slow, club-footed, hunchback style, whereas Olivier really embraces the bottled spider aspect
yes.
of Richard. Like, he is everywhere. He is just bounding around. And one thing I did while watching it just for fun, I went back and I was watching it online in perfectly legal ways, I upped the speed to, I think it was like 1.5, and the movie plays really well on 1.5 speed, because in stark contrast, and we'll get to it, to the Howl version, Olivier's is fast, and he is just constantly moving, and you get this with the way he breaks up the first two scenes. The opening scene and then the Anne wooing scene, it's just him like walking back and forth between rooms, and it's like, I gotta talk to him, now I gotta talk to her, now I'm going back to him and then to her, and just the energy is so unique and extremely well done.
Mm-hmm. Well, and something I do want to comment on first about, but you absolutely hit the nail for like, what is each one and why is this play so popular? I think, again, one of the main things we alluded to for the last time we chatted about the Henry VI plays, the biggest struggle with them is there is no protagonist in pretty much any of the plays. And it's just everyone struggling to be the protagonist. There's no question of who's the protagonist in Richard III. And he's such a... I do feel in some ways that Macbeth is somewhat Shakespeare revisiting the ideas with Richard III of the rise and fall of a tyrant. But in essence, he divides Richard III into two characters with Macbeth, and also has more supernatural elements at play. Compared to just like this pure embodiment of evil, theoretically, in Richard, of the idea of Machiavelli's prince and what he's dealing with that, it makes for such a fascinating character and such a fascinating exploration.
Absolutely. I was also thinking while watching it, you know, what makes this play so much more popular than the others? And I think you got it exactly, that it is grounded in this one character, and it is his rise and fall, and you don't need to even remotely know history because of how much Shakespeare bastardizes this history, unlike the Henry VI plays, where you don't really need to know the actual War of the Roses, but there's enough in there that you kind of have to look up and make sense of. No, Richard, you're just following this guy. Basically, right from the first monologue, here's my problem. You know, I can't be a lover, so I have to be a villain. I'm going to go do evil stuff. Come watch. And that's that universal tale that makes the popular Shakespeare plays popular.
And it is fascinating, and we touched on this before when talking about Richard in Henry VI Part 3, but it is also something that's fundamentally like, and what I love about what Olivier does, and it's also there in the Howl version and kind of every version of Richard III, but I feel the most with Howl and Olivier's complicit. You feel complicit in what you, as you watch, because on some level you kind of enjoy watching Richard be this Machiavellian, and can you blame you? Anyone for being enjoying Olivier be so just evil? Of he really just enjoys being evil. That's the biggest thing I feel for Olivier's Richard, is that he just like, why? It's not that he is an incel. It's not that he's self-loathing. It's not that he resents, like, he can't function in peacetime. It's just, he's just like, I just want to.
Yeah, Olivier is definitely having the most fun. I would say, as far as being complicit, I would give that to McKellen. I don't know, maybe it's just because he's Sir Ian McKellen and he can't not be charming, but he's definitely the most charming Richard.
Yeah.
And I think that he's the most likable out of the four of them, as far as, you know, Richard can be.
I can see that. I do feel that, well, likable is an interesting question, because Cook is the one I feel the most sympathy for. Because just everyone around him is so awful that just like, yeah, you're terrible, but so is everyone else. So I don't know exactly how to feel
there
as you do this. And And we'll talk about that too, definitely. But I mean, okay, here's one thing to immediately jump off on for what I love about Olivier's Richard is one actually just something about Olivier. Yes, he does like simplify sometimes to make it clear how to appreciate Shakespeare to, but he was introducing Shakespeare to cinema.
I don't think he simplifies. I think his problem is he doesn't. He kind of just cuts for the purpose of, because films could only be a certain length of time. I think Olivier's biggest problem is that he was constrained by the time that he was working in.
I don't necessarily feel that way. I'm just like, because I feel the surge of creativity of like, what can I do and what do I choose to do? And choosing the one to begin with an opening crawl, and also in that opening crawl, the most like acknowledging, okay, we do need to confront a little bit of the elephant in the room of just how much Shakespeare, of all the things that Shakespeare has done, beyond like creating so many phrases, beyond creating words, beyond creating a whole genre of entertainment, he created the rom-com with Much Ado About Nothing. But his work was so successful in making people think about a person a certain way that a whole society of man was dedicated to debunk the image created by Shakespeare of Richard III. Just because on some level, Richard III by Shakespeare does everything but drink blood. And you just, it's like, really? Was he this bad? Was he this evil? Now, if you ask real historians, you'll get a yes or no answer, or, well, it's complicated, but he wasn't this hunchbacked demon that you encounter when you watch Ian McKellen. I'll say that. But Olivier absolutely says that with saying, like, history and legend, but we need legends in our life. And legends are fun. So that alone is just the encouragement. This is not reality. Let's have fun. Like, we're telling a story. We're not telling history.
That is fair. And Olivier, in all three of his Shakespeare films, is very good at hinging the entire movie, the entire adaptation, on a specific theme. And I think that you're right. The whole making Richard larger than he is plays well into this one.
And so something I'm going to give major praise, although it also applies to McKellen's version, but it's a bit more transparent, I feel, in McKellen's compared to Olivier's, is costuming. I adore, especially when I look at, compared to, not in a negative way, but like the Hollow Crown, of just how drab everyone is dressed in the Hollow Crown. Compare that to the vibrancy I'm seeing for the costumes that everyone wears in the opening, and to open it with the final scene of Henry VI Part 3 at the re-coronation of Edward. That's such a more fascinating way to open the story and just give the little hint of all the events that have happened before. Although there's also a bunch of little parts of Henry VI Part 3 in Olivier's Richard III. Most importantly, that he splices up Gloucester's first monologue in Henry VI Part 3 into Now is the Winter of Our Discontent.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for me, I always just find, I guess because of the infamy / legendary quality of Brana's Hamlet, to see that Olivier was the opposite of Brana and his Hamlet, of just saying, no, I'm making a movie, man. Like, I'm going to chop up scenes and do make whole new contexts and meanings behind everything.
Well, not everything. And I pointed this out too. If you look at both Henry V and even more so in Richard III, he, after Act Two or three, yeah, after Act Two, he just stops adapting. And it's still good, and I'm not faulting him for it. It's just a very strange thing I noticed about Olivier, that if you just watch the second half of the movie, it is a straightforward, with a couple scenes missing for time, Richard III. Any kind of creative changes he made happen in the first half. And I don't know why that is. It's just he does it with both Henry V and Richard III. Hamlet's, again, a beast unto itself. Mm-hmm. But I, that's one thing I just find strange about him. It's like he got halfway through, it's, yeah, good enough. Let's just do the play now, cut for time.
No, I feel that he understands narrative pace and also what he's doing, and just making this a bit more Machiavellian, but also a little bit more comprehensible of the Anne, to make the Anne scene. But just it makes it a very interesting piece to make the Anne Neville scene be two scenes.
It is extremely interesting, and I just wish, I mean, again, time and history. Anne is not good in the Olivier film. I don't think there's a way to justify her performance. She is just the angelic, virtuous, meek woman, which is most women. Yes, she is. She pretty much most of the women in Olivier's films. I mean, the Duchess gets a bit more, and even a bit of Margaret in her, because it's worth noting that mm-hmm. Olivier cuts Margaret, as does the McKellen version. McKellen, which, yeah. I don't like it because Margaret's an amazing part of the play, but as a solo play, sans any other context, it makes perfect sense. So no qualms there. But that's the point. Yeah, Anne is not great in either of those two versions, but for different reasons.
I mean, fun fact, behind the scenes, Olivier and Claire Bloom had a little hanky-panky. She's Makes talked sense. About it. But just fun fact. But regardless of that, what I like about that, about Bloom's Anne, is that Bloom's Anne is the only one where I actually did believe that she was embarrassed and ashamed that she actually was somewhat moved by Richard and that she was attracted to him. So it's that shame and disgust that she was attracted to a monster. And it is a different type of performance compared to what people want nowadays. But she, and again, a little bit, I will say that it is that legendary quality of that. If Richard is a demon, like the woman is like this angel that has been corrupted by this demon. But what I was earlier alluding to for costuming, the subtle choice of Richard coming in vibrant, popping out red, and just slowly as the play progresses, more and more black comes into his costume.
Yeah.
And just slowly by the, which scene is it exactly? But at some point he of just the evil of what he's done infects and reflects his costuming until by the end he is just in nothing but black.
Yeah, the coronation scene in Olivier's is shot so well.
And also to have that be the, to be where an intermission was meant to be, was right when Queen Elizabeth is praised that her sons be safe. The film, first half of the film opens with a coronation, and the second half opens with a coronation.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great structuring the movie. Sidebar, bring back intermissions, people. Bring back intermissions to the movie theaters. I don't mind that Avatar was 3.5 hours long, but by goodness sakes, put in an intermission in that movie.
People have to pee. Yeah, if you could do it for a 2-hour movie, you can do it for a 3.5.
Yeah.
No, so, I can't get on board with Bloom's end, although I will say better than Annette Bening's, who is Anne in the McKellen version. She can act. I have seen movies where Annette Bening is wonderful. I don't know what happened, but wow.
Annette Bening, she's Queen Elizabeth, but we can get to that in a bit.
Yeah, no. Hang on, did I just really mess that up? Who is Anne?
Anne is, she's played by a British actress that I've seen in a bunch of things. Let's see.
I think you're right. I was thinking of Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Still to the point.
Kristen Scott Thomas.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, got my characters confused. But if we're on the topic, I think maybe unsurprisingly, Howell's version treats the women the best. That. I think overall, in terms of acting, Howell's version might be the strongest, but especially when it comes to all four of the women, and you know, Duchess usually gets short shrift.
Mm-hmm.
It's a waste of a Maggie Smith in the McKellen version, but all four in the Howell version are wonderful.
I mean, okay, one little sidebar, but just poor Maggie Smith, like, she just, when I was watching, I just thought about it. It's like, poor Maggie Smith just never got to play her age. At some point, she started being cast as old women, of that she's only a couple of years older than McKellen, but she's playing his mom. She played a grandma in Hook in the 80s.
91, and, but still.
And I'm just like, poor Maggie Smith. Why? Why did she, like, they suddenly decided, you're old, and we're going to play you as old lady. Like, why?
Because she does it really well.
Yes, she does. I'm just like, why?
Man, I mean, McGonagall might be her youngest, yeah.
But by McGonagall, it's like, no, that's kind of like your age. So, but just, ugh.
Fair. She was good in the McKellen. She just... I mean, because of the way it was cut, she just didn't get much to do.
I really adore Judi Dench, just the big kind of the equivalent of casting Patrick Stewart for Richard II, like the big celebrity name that they got for a smaller part for her as Duchess Cecily. Boy oh boy, like, her lines carry such weight and venom when I hear them. I'm just like, one who should have strangled thee when I birthed thee. I'm just like, whoa. Ouch. And her getting to the opening lines for that Hollow Crown season of take but degree away, untune that string, and hark what discord follows. I know that's from Troilus and Cressida, but whatever. So, what else about Olivier's do we want to talk about? Or do we want to move on? What do you feel about John Geigold as Clarence?
He was nothing spectacular. I mean, he's always good, obviously. Didn't stand out to me. I thought that, again, the way Clarence was treated in the Olivier was well done, more because of the way he cut the scenes. Mm-hmm. So in the script proper, Clarence appears in scene one and then scene mm-hmm. four when he is then killed. And just the fact that Olivier spread it across the first act, basically, he kept coming back in and he just chopped up those scenes. Mm-hmm. It made Clarence actually make sense within the context of Richard III as a single play, as opposed to kind of this add-on that had to be dealt with.
Yeah. And I feel honestly that he doesn't get to talk about of mercy to his killers. They just stab him immediately when he figures out what's about to happen.
That is true.
It's so shocking in how merciless it is. And it's the only version we've ever seen where he actually gets thrown into the barrel.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
And so that is, oof, just the surprising brutality. One other thing I want to compliment for Olivier's Richard that I really do love is he has actually a degree of camp to him, which is there also with McKellen's, but of just this kind of joy at being evil. And at points you can kind of laugh at him. And I don't think Olivier would grumble at you laughing at him at his performance.
No, it is absolutely camp. And if you compare it to Hamlet, which is very, you know, artistique, and
yes,
it's all, it's just, you cannot laugh at his Hamlet. No. He is definitely having fun with Richard III, and it's interesting because they're both dark plays, Hamlet and Richard III, but he definitely leans into that dark aspect of Hamlet. But with Richard III, it is just, let's go over the top. Even the battle at the end is, unlike his Henry V, which is this very glorious chivalric battle, the Richard III battle is just, all right, everyone just run at each other and have at it. It would have been fun to film that or to be on set for that one. It just seems like a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love also, I mean, again, just the color coding is very fun. And I still maintain it becomes a bit more clear when you watch it in glorious HD how he did it. But that wonderful transition that he does and then added at one point with a swipe of his sword is his men. And just we transition into it, him being in front of his army. That's quite a sight. And I like that view. Yeah. And at the end of the play, the other thing to get, I do love how Richard, just overall, like Olivier's Richard, at the same time, you do feel that desperation and in some way bravery at the end at Bosworth, in that final battle, and also the brutality of how he dies.
Yeah, his might be the most, and I'll be completely honest, I watched all four of them fairly close succession, and there's a possibility I'm getting some of them mixed up in my head. But so in the original play, the whole point is that Richard doesn't get a glorious death. He just gets that my kingdom for a horse, boom, dead.
Yep.
If I'm not misremembering, Olivier stretches out the death a bit.
Oh, well, the big thing is, first he has the duel with Richmond that's in the text, but then they separate, and then Stanley's men surround him.
That's right.
And then he's killed by them.
Yeah.
I should be clear, that Olivier does a great job with Lord Stanley. That is the most sympathetic portrayal of Lord Stanley, yes, and the most where you can see his arc of him just growing more and more disaffected by Richard the Third's actions.
Yeah. Holocron is a nice Stanley as well, but you're right.
I should also add this one because I was spoke about this earlier. In terms of great direction, just so many wonderful ideas that Olivier does, and why I bristle at that one jerk who wrote a book saying that Olivier while a great actor is not a great director. That person's a jerk. Completely disagree with that person. Olivier, all three of his movies are fantastic.
2 out of 3.
I love his Hamlet. That is my favorite Hamlet. But anyways, he's what we're going to do about the 6 Hamlets. I'd be down, but that's going to be hours upon hours or whatever. just hopefully we both agree that I do not like at all Ethan Hawke as Hamlet.
There we go. Podcast done. Watch a bunch of Hamlets, not Ethan Hawke. Sorry, you were saying about Olivier's direction.
Olivier's direction is what he does with the scene, like one of the most striking directorial moments of just the subtler art of staging is when he does his... is when he directs the scene of Hastings being betrayed and executed. And that scene, just how they, one, the bishop leaves to get strawberries, and then slowly Richard leaves and speaks to Buckingham. And at that moment, all the lords begin to slowly move away from Hastings and just go to the bishop's side. And have Hastings' kind of banal pleasantries that he's saying carry that air of desperation as he recognizes something is about to happen. That's brilliant direction and a brilliant way to play with the text.
Agreed. It is very good staging. And I will say, I started watching the Olivier version and started noticing how much he's cutting and adapting. And I had this hope, and this is probably an unpopular opinion, but I had this hope that he would cut the Hastings plot, because I really want to see a Richard III that cuts that whole plot line, because it stops Act 3 so dead for me. It just, he's not enough of a character before the scene you were just talking about, and then suddenly we're supposed to feel sympathy for him, and then he's dead. And it just seems... I get why it was in the original play, and I even get why it exists in every adaptation, because of it's very hard to maneuver the plot around it. But I wish someone would cut that. I don't think he does anything to the play.
Oh, well... we can talk a bit more about that when we go to the BBC version. And BBC version, I think BBC and Hollow Crown, we might want to talk a little bit simultaneously, just because those are the most important for their effects are so much different because of the fact that they are the fourth, or in Hollow Crown's case, third part in a cycle.
True.
Compared to
we'll put a pin in that. Do you want to jump over to the McKellen one? I have a lot of thoughts on this one. I think this was my introduction to Richard III. I'm pretty sure I saw it before I read the, so I read the play in undergrad, but I'm pretty sure I saw McKellen's before I read the play. Mm-hmm. It might also be my favorite of the four, despite the fact that it is flawed as hell. I wish it were made in the early 2010s. I think that if it had gotten a bit of the essentially House of Cards treatment, for lack of a better word, sans Kevin Spacey. Yeah. the Ian McKellen version, its setting is amazing. It is in theory, on paper, it is probably one of the best take Shakespeare and put it in a more modern setting. Not just like dressing it up, but actually staging the play or filming the movie as if it took place in, what are we saying, slightly before mid-20th century, I guess, 30s,
or
40s without World War II. It's hard to actually pin down exactly when, but, fascism without the whole baggage of World War II is when this version is supposed to be set.
Well, no, it's 100%. And, talk about the influences. And this is where ignorant Americans I won't be able to understand quite the references, although maybe The Crown might help some people start to understand it. But they're very deliberately doing this interesting melding of ideas, of the idea that it's dealing with both World War II, but also the lead up to World War II and what Britain was dealing with, of the abdication crisis. Of that, they make Edward the Fourth into Edward the Eighth, of marrying these Americans. So not just Annette Bening, but also obviously Robert Downey Jr. in his only, I'm not sure, Shakespeare movie he's ever done.
Yeah, he certainly does a lot in this one. Like, I know you can't really call it a waste of a Robert Downey Jr. because he was a very different actor in 1995.
Yes.
But yeah. It's one of those, hey, he's in that moments.
Yeah. Well, they really like, okay, they do what a lot of people do plenty of times, of just poster the fact that Robert Downey Jr. is in this movie. And it's not like, well, that's not a lie.
He has one scene.
He has like two.
Two scenes, right. And I do like that basically it's, yeah, we got Robert Downey Jr. Let's kill him in the most Robert Downey Jr. way we can. At least circa 1995.
Yeah, 1995 Robert Downey Jr. Absolutely. Like his reputation, yeah. It's kind of almost like that kind of Charlie Sheen level of just meta-ness.
Yeah.
But just like, wow, Robert Downey Jr. plays a drunk, obnoxious guy. How on earth did he somehow find that?
So back to what I was saying, I love everything about the aesthetics of this movie. And I think it's so well done. And I think what's holding it back beyond some bad acting choices is that it should essentially be longer. They should have somehow stretched it out more and turned this into a proper political thriller, basically, or political drama. I think it would have done well in the early Netflix days.
Well, and that's interesting ideas. And I'm McKellen's is such a wonderful mixed bag for me. I both really like it, and at the same time, in some ways, I feel it both is the most interesting and my least favorite. I'm not sure. It's definitely so fascinating with that whole abdication crisis, and then just like a weak king can lead to fascism, and turning Richard III into a metaphor for fascism is so wonderfully applaudable, I would say. And also, I mean, McKellen's Richard III it's great. His great sequel companion would be Patrick Stewart when he made Macbeth into a parable about the rise of a communist dictator. So recommend that, Macbeth. I've done a podcast. It's fun, Macbeth. It is like a bit, honestly, like when you read the stories of like, why did the fascists rise? It is just these incompetent boobs, and militarism becomes more and more fashionable, and people rally to strength. But the one thing I mildly will say, and a little bit peppering my theory, is even though Richard III does mostly stand on its own, you really need Henry VI Part III to understand some of the best scenes in the play. And I think that's why they have to include the king and the prince getting killed by Richard in the beginning of the movie, to make the Anne Neville scene make sense. Although it's also, what an iconic opening to make Richard into Darth Vader. Him coming in, killing people in smoke and wearing a gas mask and having that Vader-like breathing sound.
Yeah.
That's an iconic cinema opening. And the other thing I'll automatically give praise to McKellen, he's probably one of the only ones that actually conveys the the now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer right, I feel. So many people read, now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the son of York, as an ominous line. And that's not meant to be an ominous line.
I think it's a fair reading. I mean, the ominous, on its surface, literally, no, it's not. But he's still bitter about that fact. And I think that, you know, Ron Cook conveys that well, that it's like just, it's annoying.
Well, and that first section of that soliloquy is just supposed to be, it's sarcastic, but it's celebratory. It's only when he says, but I, that's when the switch and you know, oh, this guy's evil.
Yeah.
Like this guy.
McKellen does do it very well.
To have the first half be the speech that he's saying before his family as a celebration of the victory.
I like that reading. I don't agree that it's the only one.
I don't think so because, yeah, I don't think that either. But I mean that in general, of just so many people think of now as the winter of our discontent, just this ominous evil line, when it's not meant to be an ominous evil line necessarily.
No.
I mean, that's kind of how Cumberbatch reads it, not to be mean, but...
Oh, we'll get to Cumberbatch. I have. as I said, I think McKellen does bring out that charming aspect, and he is, he's more the politician. You know, if Olivier is just the campy, evil spider, mm-hmm. McKellen is... He's playing it as you can believe this Richard exists. He is not he is so clearly evil. Nobody would ever take him seriously. You can understand why, one, people would follow him and people would be won over by him. I don't think it's the best version of the Anne wooing scene by far, but except it's shot beautifully. But it's definitely plausible. I think that's his best quality.
Yes, he has this handsome devilish quality to him, and so okay, let's get talk a little bit about Annette Bening then.
Yeah, sorry, I did confuse her and for Elizabeth, but anyway,
I mean something about Rich the Third that I do appreciate, that Some of these, but I think actually most of them do pick up on, is that so many of these play, is that this play really is about women being ignored.
Oh, yeah.
Of just all the women see completely through Richard. All the women completely see through Richard of like, no, like, we're not fooled by this. You are a monster.
And just,
no, well, I mean, when we talk about Cumberbatches, I love what Phoebe Fox does with Anne.
Sure.
You can give me this ring and I'll take it, but like, that doesn't mean I love you.
No, Anne's, I mean, my read on Anne in that moment is she is just, and I guess this gives credit to Olivier's Anne, she is looking for the best. She truly believes in that moment anyone can be redeemed, and you know, the best mm-hmm. we can do is hope, and if because she's not willing to kill him, she has to try and help reform him, and I think that's, again, that's my read on it, mm-hmm. which, and I noticed this, I think it comes out well in most of the versions, best in Howells. You compare that Anne wooing scene to the Elizabeth wooing scene in Act 4,
yes.
And they mirror each other so wonderfully.
And that's why you need both of them, quite frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think all four versions. McKellen's. No. Did McKellen cut it?
McKellen kept it.
Olivier cut it. Yeah, sorry. Olivier.
Even though he keeps the reference that he needs to marry
Euro.
Edward's daughter, which, interesting. Now, oh, okay. Sidebar. So, but let's talk. But it is related to the movie. So, I am so fascinated by like Dominic West and his career trajectory of when you see him in this and in Midsommar, he was at one point cast as these nice, handsome, wholesome, nice guys. And then like he ended up somehow just transforming with The Wire into playing these rogues and like being these kind of jerks. I mean, he gets shot in the first scene of Chicago for being a lying, philandering jerk. And even him playing Prince Charles. Prince Charles isn't a paragon of virtue. I'm sorry, I don't want to be too mean to your king. But
don't care.
But so just like Dominic West, like being like this utterly sexy and sweet, wholesome Richmond, as Richmond is pretty much always portrayed as this the nicest man who ever walked the earth, as Tudor propaganda. And I also get why they portray him like that, because like in contrast to Ian McKellen's Richard by the end of being this Hitler analog, just this not. But it is like very fascinating to see him like then marry Elizabeth. We get a scene of him marrying Elizabeth and them happily in bed together.
Yeah, I do like that. I don't like the way that the Elizabeth wooing scene plays out in the McKellen version, mostly because Annette Bening. But I do like how they, I mean, yeah, it's giving it a more classic Hollywood style ending, but I like how they actually showed that and made that part of the ending.
I actually do think, but Annette Bening, so what they chose to do, they chose to give a lot of Margaret's lines to Richard. Of calling him a bottled spider when they're having dinner and having that fight. And okay, I've mentioned this before, maybe talking a little bit about the play itself. And again, what Shakespeare does, Tudor prop, as horrible histories put it in a song, Tudor propaganda, it's just absurd. I'm Richard III, and I'm just a nice guy. But one of the many things that's odd is if you cut out all the scenes of Richard's soliloquies, Richard could almost play like a little bit closer to what the real Richard was like, of this pious man who didn't like the court and wasn't popular in the court and was mostly in the north of England for most of his brother's second reign. And it's just that we have those soliloquies, we know that everything he says for his image is false and that it's nothing but a cynical ploy. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating, especially when you compare it to where he'll eventually go with Henry V, where everything is mostly sincere. And you have to, and quite frankly, I feel most people directing it bring in cynicism. Compared to the cynicism being there in Richard III, of just this image that Richard had was all false, because the real person was this person who would kill all these people and do anything to get the crown. Which I don't know if I completely buy for the real Richard III, in as much as I'm not a Ricardian. I don't believe he was a saint. I don't believe that he was a saint and has been so besmirched by the Tudors. No, he did lop off William Hastings' head. He had reasons, and they're actually pretty understandable, but he definitely did summarily execute William Hastings. And he also summarily executed the Woodvilles. Without giving them a trial. So, I mean, that's kind of more lordly courtroom antics, but yeah. And his claim to the throne was flimsy, and it sounds pretty convenient. It's more what you feel about Edward the Fourth of could Edward the Fourth really be so stupid as to have like done this pre-contract? And I don't know. When I've asked history fans on some threads, like, what do they think? It's always 50-50 of like, it sounds convenient, but Edward was such a horn dog, it's not that hard to believe.
I can't speak to that either way because I don't know enough about the history, but I do like how Shakespeare approaches it, and putting Tudor propaganda aside, when it comes to Edward's infidelities within the context of this play, we get the two big points are, so there's the scene where Richard is, you know, at his prayers and Buckingham does the whole charade, getting the people to basically anoint him king. Buckingham brings up the point. Edward's son is a bastard. Edward.
Yes.
Edward is not our king. Edward V is not a king because he's a bastard. And then we get it again in the Elizabeth wooing scene. She basically says, just leave her alone. I will swear she is not Edward's.
Yes.
And so what Shakespeare is doing, he's taking this fact or fiction, to be honest, it doesn't really matter in the end. He's taking this point and he's saying, this is the pawn. When you open yourself up to this reputation, this is the tool that anyone can use against you, or anyone can use to for their own gain, whether it's Richard's gain or Elizabeth trying to preserve her daughter's life, basically. And it's such an interesting way, and you think about it within the context of 16th century England, slightly more puritanical, and how would that audience have reacted? Would the audience mirror the audience that Buckingham has before him and saying, yeah, maybe he's right. Maybe Edward the Fourth was that much of a player.
Yeah. Well, we should also mention, like, Olivier's put so much more emphasis on Jane Shore.
Yes, I forgot about that. Should have taken better notes. That is hilarious. So in the text, I did look it up at the time, and again, I should have taken notes. I think she gets two references.
Yeah.
One at the beginning when Richard's talking to Clarence, and then one again in that Buckingham scene. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so not only does Olivier put her in the film, but just the amount of times he manages to reference her is... it's truly admirable. Like, that's a choice. It's like, I like that choice.
And that's what everyone says after Hastings dies. Like, yeah, he kept on sleeping with that Jane Shore, so I don't really feel that bad that he's dead.
That Jane got around.
So, well, yeah, she did. She was mistress to Edward the Fourth, Hastings, and Queen Elizabeth's son.
But then says Henry the Seventh. Who knows?
Then she just got married to Richard III's Solicitor General and then just goes away. So, fun. I did put on my notes, Tim McInerney, after Blackadder, he made sure after Blackadder to never play Blackadder-like characters again. Just wonderfully treacherous. Wonderfully treacherous as Catesby. Definitely liked his Catesby.
Yeah.
Oh, and just fun little bit in that I do remember is the prayer book in quotes in McKellen's is just like this random like pulp book that they just take the dust jacket off to make it look like a prayer book.
Yeah. McKellen, so, I like the way McKellen does that scene. It's Olivia's version is good as well. This is where I kind of start to notice with Howell's version how much how dour it is, because I think that you do have to ham it up a bit. This is a complete farce, and everybody essentially knows it, except for the mayor of London, who,
yeah,
you know, poor mayors throughout this entire, every time a mayor appears in this tetralogy, just the stupidest guy in town. And so I think that, yeah, the way McKellen's version of Olivia's does ham it up a bit works, as opposed to the more just playing it straight, because no, it's not, it's ceremonial. It doesn't really matter what the people think. It's just good to have them on your side. Might as well.
Well, so. The great Raymond for the Olivier version is when they have like this crowd of people, like Buckingham tries to incite them to cheer for Richard, and like no one does.
Yeah.
Which is a great line. But overall, I don't mind, although I understand why you have problems with Annette Bening. I think that she was great for the Elizabeth wooing scene. That I'm just like utter disgust of just like the idea, just the idea. And finally, the creepiness of him kissing her at the end.
That was played well. And again, I think she's a good actress. She just, so my impression, my take on Annette Bening in this version is, it's like she's trying to do an accent of her own voice.
I can understand that, yes.
Very strange. I couldn't figure it out.
She was cast to be an American, so.
Exactly. Yeah. She's like, she is an American trying to do what a British person would think an American sounds like.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that North Atlantic is what she's trying to do. But
maybe. It's very off-putting, and it forces her lines to be very stilted. Mm-hmm. It just takes away the flow of it, including the wooing scene. So I do like the staging, but yeah.
I mean, she also comes across as a histrionic woman, which is why she's easily like brushed aside, like her concerns and her fears.
Yeah.
Of like, yeah, we know.
I mean, I do like that aspect because it's in the text. Richard is awful to Elizabeth. He basically paints her as everything that is wrong in the world is because of Elizabeth. That's yep. in the text. And McKellen brings that out very well. Making her this awful person.
To mildly reference the real history again, that is like what the real Richard did. But again, where Shakespeare is very nice, or Tudor propaganda, whichever one you want to call it, Elizabeth is really just a nice lady in this, and is just being picked on by Richard, who's really a cynical jerk. So, like in reality, I don't think Elizabeth was quite so innocent. I think she was trying to do something of a coup d'etat, and Richard kind of just said nope, and then just kind of decided, I don't think I can actually be Lord Protector. I don't think this actually works, so maybe I should just be king. And also, like, lords, show of hands, who wants a boy king again? No, we just went through Henry VI, so no, absolutely not.
Yeah, Edward V would not have been not any good, especially Olivier's. Like, we should acknowledge that piece of child acting. So there's that scene where Richard and co go to meet Edward, Prince Edward, and then young Richard of York comes to join them. And not only does Olivier / the child playing Edward V have this horrible line delivery of, like, they have this very natural flowing conversation, and then Edward walks away, and basically, I'm paraphrasing, says, where shall I repose? Oh, and then Richard says, I think you shall repose you in the tower. Dramatic pause. I do not like the tower or any place. And it's just, it's as if it was just filmed completely separately, which it might have been. It might have been like, had to do another take and they had to slot it into the movie. It's completely out of place. But add to that, then you have the scene where, right after, where Richard of York jumps on Richard's back and Olivier just has dramatic music and like fends after a face turn and just really plays that up. And this is part of the whole camp of his version, but it is hilarious and probably not for the right reasons.
Although it was just like them having to emphasize, because that dirty look is scary.
Yeah.
But it's just,
But you compare that to McKellen, just his suaveness in that moment, even though he is clearly just pissed off and hates kids. He plays it very coolly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And also the way that Cook does it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cook is all around his Richard is, if we want to start sliding into the Howl version, I think his Richard is very solid all the way through.
Okay, but let's actually, before that, though, final note for McKellen's. That death scene is a choice.
I like it.
That's part of like where I was like, what? I'm not sure what to make of this. And along with him just shooting his driver because he can't get him out, it's like, what? Why would you... And just committing suicide is like, okay, that's a choice. And then also, quite frankly, the end credits is such a like a what? It's, that's the music for the end credits?
Again, I like it despite the fact that it's flawed. It's very mid-90s. That was the style at the time.
It is, and like that's a choice.
I do like how they modernized the battle. I like how they didn't just try and keep it. You know, medieval style, despite the modern setting. I think the battle worked for, this probably wasn't the highest budget movie around.
No.
Obviously. But so I think what they were working with, I think that scene actually plays out quite well. And I don't know. I like it. I think that I like that they got rid of the Richmond Elizabeth plot first. And they wrapped that up and then did Richard's death. Obviously, within the context of Shakespeare and his plays, it doesn't make sense that way. But I like that it doesn't just end with Richmond, but it starts and ends with Richard in this version.
Yes. It's all wonderful touch.
I know it's as good as the Howl ending, but we'll get to that.
No. Howl ending is the best. Yes. Easily. Yes. 100% the best. So now let's talk about the two BBC TV ones, and also making sure that Richard III is part of a cycle and what that does. So Cumberbatch's Richard III was my first Richard III. And to prep for watching for this podcast, I went through the Hollow Crowns, Henry VI, their version of what they call Henry VI Part 1 and Henry VI Part 2.
Which is really Part 3, because they just cannibalized Part 2.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
The bigger thing is like they keep the last scene of Henry VI Part 2 mostly, and then it's just Henry VI Part 3. I'm a bit more ambivalent for the adaptation choices. I both really like and understand why they made those choices. It's just, it feels a bit too much simplifying at times. And that's a bit annoying to me.
I agree. And my take on the Hollow Crown, I mentioned this to you, but basically everything in both seasons of the Hollow Crown outside of Richard II is, it's good. It's very competent. It's enjoyable, but I'm not wowed by any of it. There were some aspects, like, for example, sidetrack, I know, but in their Henry VI Part 2, which is really Part 3, when you actually see the sacking of the town of York at the beginning, I thought that was an interesting choice, and kudos for actually slipping the Duchess into the story prior to Richard III, because that makes zero sense if you take them as four separate plays. So I like that we actually got the Duchess, and so I think Hollow Crown, similar to something like McKellen's version, really understood what it was trying to do. That yes, it took Richard III as part of the cycle, and it did the events leading up to Richard III, but it essentially had its own agenda of, here's this three-part series that is the Shakespeare plays, but it is its own unit, and we'll cut whatever we see fit, all for the service of what everyone is here for, Richard III. So I think all choices contribute to that.
The adapter, the script adapter, and the director, Dominic Cook, the director, and he, in their making of feature for the DVD that I own, they say that what is the main theme for the second season of The Hollow Crown was, what kind of situation will you be in where you go from Henry V to egomaniacal tyrant in Richard III? And that was their goal. So everything that they made in their direction and choices was, this all builds up to Richard III being crowned.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why just smush and get everything you need of Henry VI to get to Richard being a character in part three. And just so ominously building up with the end of their Henry VI part one, of the final scene is York talking to his sons, and then just Richard, and that's the to be continued, is Richard walking into frame.
And that's the thing. Unlike the Hal version, which treats each of the four plays with the respect it deserves, quote unquote, Hollow Crown is, no, we're here for Richard. Here's his backstory. No, let's get to Richard. And I'm not blaming it for that. I don't think that's a fault. I think that's what they were going for, and they execute it well.
Absolutely. Well, and I feel when I watch them now that Henry VI Part 1 and 2 feel a little bit more just, oh my gosh, we got to do these plays, but then we'll get to Richard III. Because I feel they were so much more excited to do Richard III.
Agreed.
But that being said, okay, one, two things. Just love the actor they got to play Warwick. What a very interesting actor body type, and what a magnificent voice.
Yeah.
Just a very memorable take on Warwick that I like. And also, the one thing is that a little bit of the subtlety is lost, I feel. That's one of the reasons why I say simplification, of that combining Suffolk and Somerset as one character, it does make things more powerful, but it also makes Somerset just so evil. He's just pretty much nothing but evil. Unquestionably evil.
True, but I don't know if the actual text comes by consequence
just much more inherently the good guy, which is like, I'm not sure that's supposed to be how you should approach this text.
It is a bit simple, but is there really anything redeeming about Somerset in the text itself? He's maybe not as evil, but he's certainly incompetent in the original text.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I actually, again, looking at what they're trying to do, I think that choice works out well. But
it's if you believe what Somerset says when they go in part one to him and say, like, we need your help, and it's just like, York lied. And it's whether you choose to believe York or Somerset.
Right. And whether you believe that's the same Somerset.
Yeah.
But I think by the time you get to part two, Somerset is clearly the villain. And I don't think you're supposed to be able to side with him in the text. Yeah.
No, but that's a whole...
Yeah.
Anyway.
Let's jump over to Richard III.
Ben Miles was wonderful as Somerset. And I do like Okonedo, what she's doing with Margaret. It's an interesting take. A more haughty Margaret.
Yeah, I do like her better in Henry the Sixth part, her Henry the Sixth version than her Richard the Third. But she's good. It's not my favorite.
No, I mean, yeah, Julia Foster is just in a whole other league. So I really do. I guess we're gonna all carry up to maybe the best with the BBC version at the end. So Cumberbatch, he makes a choice. I mean, all the actors like have to make a choice for the physical deformity of Richard. And just how much he really wants to be like, no. Compare that to like Olivier's, whose hunch is, it's there, but it's not like transparently obvious. Much more like his limp and his shriveled hand are much more prominent, but even then, he's not like quite what I think Cumberbatch goes for, almost more medieval, of just like, wow, you are a hunchback. And to have his Richard open shirtless and prominently feature the misshapen back. That's quite a choice. That's quite a choice to open it up.
Yeah, and I have very mixed feelings on Cumberbatch, and I think most of it, I haven't watched any, you know, behind the scenes. I don't know what was Cumberbatch's decision, what was directorial. I'm going to blame the director for most of the things I don't like about it. But I think that they really wanted to shorthand Richard. They wanted to make it basically for promo material. This is who this guy is. One look at him and you can tell everything. And I think that for that reason, yeah, Cumberbatch is lacking subtlety that you find in the other three Richards that we're looking at. One, because to an extent, he's just playing Cumberbatch. He's almost always just playing himself. But I think that mostly this goes back to what you're saying about the oversimplifying. I think that they try and just make everything as surface as possible to get the point across.
I can see that. One of the biggest things, though, I will say, just looking at Cumberbatch's career, I think that he, like, when I look at what he did with the Frankenstein play he did with Danny Boyle and with Johnny Lee Miller, when I look at this, and when I look at the behind-the-scenes footage of him playing Smaug, I think he really likes being a character actor more than being a leading man.
Fair.
I think, like, him playing Khan, spoiler alert, Khan, he played Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness, is like, okay, you really want me to be this pretty boy? Like, I got nothing, like, physical abnormalities. Like, at least with the Marvel movies, I got funky hands. It's like, nope. Like, all right, but I'm playing a genocidal dictator and I can go big, right? Yeah, all right, fine then, yes. I will do a shirtless shower scene if I can play big. Because I think he really just loves to the idea of, like, acting. That's kind of my own
impression. No, that's fair. And that's actually why I like him far better as the monster than Frankenstein in that version of Frankenstein.
I just find that, like, for me, it's the reverse. Like, I find him so much better when he does do, like, as much as he doesn't like it, I think he's better when he's, like, those kind of more Victor Frankenstein of just, like, this kind of cold, aloof dude.
Mm.
And that's why he was good for Doctor Strange, of just being this kind of Like, I get magic, and I'm a surgeon. Like, I don't get people. People, it's kind of weird. I can't relate quite to people. And that's a little bit... Cumberbatch's Richard, I really like. He's really good at playing evil people, I think. But, I mean, he both loves to play bad guys, but he also always insists, like, but I want them to not be just pure evil. We need to have some sympathetic outlet. And the most cheapest way to earn sympathy in his Brexit movie, just like, but he's got a pregnant wife. Of this guy masterminded the Brexit move and maybe made politics in Britain worse, but he's got a pregnant wife. So he's not all that bad, right?
Yeah, see, I didn't get... And don't get me wrong, there's a lot that I like about Holacern Richard III, including there's some that I like about, you know, Cumberbatch's performance. I think that he is a good actor. He's just a bit samey. And first of all, the Holacern is the best looking out of all of them, for obvious reasons, but it's it is a beautiful production. And some of the choices to shoot some of the scenes where they did, also fantastic. But I don't get the sense that he is trying to be redemptive. I don't get the sense that he is trying to be nuanced. I think he is just leaning into the pure Machiavellian aspects of Richard.
I don't necessarily, because one, we got what he was going for and what they wanted to do with his Henry VI Part II very much feeds into his Richard III performance, of that Richard is someone who was corrupted by the war. That's absolutely what they go for, of that when he gets the new original scene of after he stabbed Clifford, he's going to give him a mercy kill until Clifford says, give me mercy. And that's when it's like, actually, nah, I'm not going to do that.
Right, but I think even...
And just like the war brings out this sadism in him. But the bigger thing, I think, for what they want to go for, and I feel is intentional and why they go for that more emphasis on the physical deformity, is Cumberbatch's Richard is a man who is just like, by what he says, I'm not shaped for peace and I'm not shaped for love. So if I cannot, then I'm determined to be a villain, is that he feels that he's been born this way. He's born, there's nothing he can be but evil, so I will be evil.
Right, and that's the aspect of Richard as a character in the Shakespeare play that always, I don't know, I push up against for various reasons. But I agree, I think that's, yeah, opposite end of that coin. I do like that, you know, the Cumberbatch Richard is shaped by the plays, because we do get the full cycle. But at the same time, I think the aspects of Richard from Henry VI Part III that show him as the more dutiful son, as the more just doing what's right for family honor, that was kind of subverted to make way for this just warmonger, just, you know, violent version that we get with Cumberbatch.
Well, I mean, but that's what he, but that's the whole transformation of, he went from that. He went from the good boy to...
Right. What I'm saying is, we don't get the first part. You're filling in the blanks there. The Holocron doesn't show the transformation, really. They just show more of the post-transformation. Like, we don't get the first part of Richard.
I feel I do get it in Henry VI Part II with, like, what I said earlier of, like, the dispatch. Nope, I'm not going to be merciful. And later on, him being the one who both kills Warwick, and then later on, finally, like, killing the prince. Just him.
Yeah.
Just him killing the prince instead of all three of the York sons. I'm just... That war made him more and more sadistic. And then finally, at the end, just... then killing Prince King Henry, and that ominous great direction to have him hold Prince Edward at the end, that'd be the final shot. That's like, ooh, that's ominous.
And it's, I mean, again, it's extremely well shot all the way through, and it's set up as a three-parter, so you need your good ending bits there. And I'm not going to, you know, discount your reading of it. I think you're just flipping the script a bit. It's the way Holocram presents it isn't so much war makes him sadistic. It's just he is sadistic and therefore well-suited to war.
Okay, well.
That's not going to be resolved here.
Okay, well, and then, and so going through, this is, I think that this is an easier one to just show to regular people who don't like Shakespeare. And like, I like Benedict Cumberbatch, and like, I can understand this. This is good.
Yeah, my assessment is, if you look at it purely objectively, Holocron is probably the best one. It doesn't rise to as great heights, but it doesn't have the flaws that the others do. It's definitely not my favorite, but it is, you said it well. It is the best. It is, if I wanted somebody to experience Richard III, I would say watch The Holocron season 2.
And so, but I mean, and appreciate, but I'm going to appreciate it more, I will be honest, in Richard in the BBC, is also making sure that what you appreciated about Cumberbatch's one, just like you do much more with the BBC, is this is all part of a cycle. Is that you know why it's so weird and uncomfortable that Anne Neville is being wooed by Richard, because you've seen him kill her wife, her husband, that she's mourning in that scene. And it's also weird. You don't feel that George of Clarence is as innocent because you've seen him betray his brothers in the previous play and also kill Exeter. So how do you feel about that scene? And it's just a bit more fascinating, a bit more compelling in that way, of that everyone is a bit more a shade of gray.
Oh, absolutely.
So clear cut, good versus evil, which I feel that's the reverse of that is, and that's why Richard III isn't as interesting of a play to me, quite frankly, if you watch it in isolation, because in isolation, just then Richard is a demon, and then you get, why not just make him a Nazi then?
It's
McKellen. And I don't disagree with that. If you watch it in isolation and read it in isolation, then yeah, then yes, he is pure evil. He is pure evil. Whereas Richard scheming to put down bad people that you know from other plays, like, this person isn't that good. I don't know what to feel as they die. And it also makes it more fun, theoretically, to watch Richard do his Machiavellian schemes, because pretty much everyone he kills up to the prince is like, like, are they that innocent? Are they that innocent? And it's just when he kills, the prince is like, wait, what? Okay, whoa.
It's fair, and we touched on this last time, that it's hard to judge, especially if you have gone through the cycle in order, it's hard to judge, you know, can you appreciate Richard III on its own? Essentially, you have to pretend like you don't know what comes before. I think that to defend it as a solo play, the first two scenes exist in part to set up the backstory. So the first monologue, everything with Clarence, sets up everything that happened with Edward in Henry VI Part 3, and then the Anne scene sets up the killing of Henry, who we see in the Howl version, and Anne's husband as well. So, I don't want to rehash the argument because we're not going to come to an agreement, but I think it works to Howells. So I said that I think Cumberbatch is like the best objectively and the one to show ordinary people to introduce them to the play. That being said, Howell, if for no other reason that she actually presents the text with very minimal cuts, is able to deliver the needed subtlety. But I've alluded to this throughout the recordings here, it's dour. It's okay. It is.
It is.
And I don't know. I don't, you know, it is the most stark contrast to Olivier's. Olivier's fast-paced, mm-hmm. whereas every moment in Howl's is drawn out. And there are some amazing moments, both the wooing scenes, the Anne and the Elizabeth, fantastic. The Elizabeth Duchess Margaret scene, amazing. The killing of Hastings scene works really well here. So and the end scene's fantastic. So it has its moments, and it's like every piece of it is good, but when you put it all together, it's a chore. And that's
I did feel that a little bit. I did feel the running time, but I still think it is fantastic. It's not my favorite of Howl's in the cycle. That still is Henry VI Part 3. And Henry VI Part 2 is starting to rub off better to me. But Richard III is phenomenal of what she does and what the direction. So tipping back a little bit, just to talk a little bit more about Hollow Crown, one of the things the Hollow Crown goes for is to have the recurring image of the mirror.
Oh, yeah.
And to have...
And the chess. That was Hollow Crown, right? I'm not getting confused. Yes. Okay.
And the chess. And so both of those are very powerful images. And also just forcing the idea of reflection, of reflecting on what you've done. But as much as that, and connecting to the overall idea of the cycle, is that's so on everyone's mind when you watch Richard III. And for me, okay, I'm going to bring it up, Alex, I'm sorry, but to me, I always maintain that these are, and Howl in particular, made this into a cycle, into a four-part story. And
yes, she did.
Made it really clear that watching Richard III alone is like watching Return of the Jedi alone. You can, and it's still a good movie, but you haven't gone on a journey with Han, Luke, and Leia for two more movies before. So the catharsis just isn't the same. And the climax just doesn't feel the same. In the biggest thing that I picked on for Howl's is how much Richard III in her hands, whereas so many others are just interested in the Machiavellian and scheming and things like that. One, the big immediate choice that everyone notes, only Richard dies on screen. Only Richard dies on screen. And they have to fight that in particular with George's death, but even George, it's off screen. We just see the barrel and hear the sounds.
Yeah.
And it's pretty ominous and it's pretty brutal, but that's all we hear. The death of, and I alluded to this earlier, but what they do with Catesby, your favorite bit actor who played Aiden and King Louis, comes in to play Catesby. And his Catesby, just this man who just wears these glasses, almost like Heinrich Himmler.
Oh, he is definitely, he is. Like, Howl's version isn't as Nazi-coded as Ian McKellen's, but Catesby for sure.
And just like just this ominous sound of just the scratching a quill onto a parchment, and that's all it takes for people to die, as Grey, Vaughn, and Rivers are about to be executed. Just so ominous. And that's such a chilling scene right there. And even that we don't have to see the princes die, we just can hear it from the actor who we formerly saw play Warwick describe it. And that's chilling. And getting into that sort of Nazi theme of just the banality of evil, of just that death can just be pushing a button. Just command someone to do that, they do that, and people die. Just like that. Unlike war of just big in your face stab, just quiet deception, quiet, it's just scratching someone's name off the list. And But getting into performances, what I love about Cook is both that he is the worst of the bunch, but he isn't a demon. Everyone around him is so complex and so mercurial and gray. I don't know what to feel, and that's wonderful. That's wonderful that this is just like, we are in hell now. We are just, I am in hell surrounded by demons. And yes, in that metaphor, then Richard is Satan, but just, who else do you have around you? And that's also why it's pivotal to have Margaret in the play, is just right after Edward and after Richard is having his fight with the Woodville family, to then suddenly have Margaret show up and remind everyone of their own sins. And then them having to combat by saying, hey, wait a minute, but you stabbed Rutland. And that continuity of just, what do you feel for Margaret? Of, on the one hand, I feel pity for her. And earlier we said how much Julia Foster believably was a very young woman. Just how believably ancient she is.
Yeah. It is insane. This
revenant. Okonedo tries, but like not in this wet level with just minimal makeup and just costuming. Foster looks like she's aged 50 years.
It is crazy when you see that it's the same actress. And yeah, she just, I mentioned this during our first one, but watching her here and then in Henry VI Part 1, the fact that those are the same people is nuts. And I agree. And I said, you know, I think Margaret, it's a shame to cut Margaret. I do completely understand why you do when you're just doing the solo play. Mm-hmm. It also, what she brings to this play as well, and I think it comes across the best in Foster's, so Canada does decent with it, is that idea, the supernatural, and how much cursing actually plays into this play in both Margaret's scenes and then the teach us how to curse bit. And that is the, what Margaret lends to Richard III as a play is that supernatural gravity, that ominous threat. And I don't know, this is the one part that I think it actually makes more sense to not know her backstory as far as the Henry VI Part 3 plays goes. Because, yeah, I'll agree with you. It absolutely humanizes her more, and in that sense does make her a more complex character.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes away a bit of her function in this play, which is to be this evil presence to everyone who has done her wrong, or everyone who has just done wrong, this kind of angel of vengeance type of figure.
Okay, well... I agree with the angel of vengeance this is what Howell also brings in. And what I said earlier about bad people dying is how much that this, like, she's also the conscience of the play, conscience of the play in a way of saying like, no, all you people are awful. Not just Richard. All you people are awful. Cause you betrayed the House of Lancaster. Like, you are all awful. You're all traitors. You are not good people. Like, none of the people that are about to die are good either. And, like, you have this riches and thrones off of the blood of my husband and son. So, how innocent are you people?
Right. And I think that comes across really well. But even more so when you don't know about her kind of defeat as a general back in Henry VI Part 3.
I disagree, but I can understand your point of view. So, I mean, in particular, just what I feel for George and as he dies, and that the actor, but it's also in the holocron, but just how much of just like, I don't know what to feel, but George's penitence as he's about to die ties into another theme that Howell is able to bring out, because it's almost always cut, is, even though they keep it with Edward IV's speech in just about every production, is the idea that everyone gets these moments in the play to reflect on what they have done and feel penitence and guilt for what they've done, is that Richard III, and this is why it needs to be a cycle. I'm going to maintain this theory, Alex, I'm sorry, but is just how much everyone is just reflecting on what they have done. And sometimes it's and a bunch of the times it's referencing other plays and for characters that don't. And just how everyone is this shade of gray until we get to those innocent princes dying, even though the Duke of York is a bit of a brat. Of just George reflecting on, I betrayed the House of... And as he's about to die, the murderers bring up, like, hey, you betrayed the House of Lancaster.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why they justify killing him. So it's like, oh, yeah.
But even in his soliloquy, he's reflecting on his evils, and I think that it...
And it plays more as not an ominous of, like, I'm about to be drowned. It plays more like, oh, I've done a lot of things. I'm going to hell.
Yeah. I love that soliloquy, by the way. Just the...
Mm-hmm.
His nightmare. Very well.
And that
one of the top.
Yeah. That actor's performance was really great for that scene.
Yeah.
But also, getting back to the Brian Prothero for Edward IV, I feel so much more like both pity and also just like, I'm just like, you've always been like proud, stubborn, kind of bro-y guy. Like, when he hears the news that George is dead, that carries so much more weight if you've seen him in two other plays before, and the guilt he feels. Just that order was rescinded. Of just that desperation. Just a great performance by Brian Prothero as Edward. Again, his own reflection on what evils I have done of just like, I wanted to save my brother. Like, why did you not trick me into killing him? Why? What's going on? What have I done? And just then he dies of heartbreak.
He also has... kind of remorse over what happened with Warwick comes across there too.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. I'm not giving up the point. I think it's still undercut by the Warwick Edward fight in Henry VI Part III. Sort of. Not so much in that case. I don't know. Edward IV within the context of just Richard III is it's a strange role.
Yes.
It's one that I played when I was in the production.
Oh. And
because he's only in that one scene, and he has that one moment, and that one moment does a lot of heavy lifting. And again, this is taking the play as isolation. That one scene does a lot. So you don't really... I don't know. Even considering the cycle, I don't really feel anything for Edward IV. Like, yeah, he was a bastard. He wasn't anything great. He doesn't deserve to be king, so go away. But at the same time, that speech can be done extremely powerfully. And I think, Brother does it very well.
It's because of the emotions and, again, the penitence and, like, the complexity of just... One moment he's very angry at his brother for betraying him. The next he's like, but I didn't want him to die. And he came back.
Like, there's also that moment that I forgot about because I think every single production except for Howells cuts it, where he's basically saying, what was it? I let my brother die, but I'll lift a hand to save this slave when, you know, he's being sued for mercy. And just that... kind of powerful powerlessness comes across very well in that moment.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't talked about this in any of them, but absolutely my favorite take on Buckingham is the actor who plays him in the BBC production. of just Buckingham is such a wonderful character. And I love how both handsome and sly the actor that they got to play Buckingham for Howl is.
Yeah.
And is just, he was the pirate who killed Suffolk.
There we go.
And and he was the father who killed his son in Henry VI Part 3. So he's had plenty of like bit roles, and this is where he gets to really shine as Buckingham, as just this wonderful scheming monster. And at the same time, though, then get weirded out by Richard plotting to kill the princes.
Yeah, Buckingham is probably my favorite male role in Richard III. I think he is wonderfully complex. I actually really like the way, I can't remember his plays him now, but McKellen's version. I think he's good in that as far as this, like the sideman. But I agree that in Howl's, we get to see the charming, and I think it is this powerful moment when Margaret is going around cursing everyone and basically goes to Buckingham and says, "You're the one good person. Don't get mixed up in all of this." And he just brushes her off, and that's his downfall right there. That's why, you know, his final bit is, "Oh, Margaret, now your words are true," or something like that. And yeah, he is, in a sense, the most and least moral, ethical out of everyone there. He's basically playing both sides. In the production that I was in, and I this was double casting by necessity in a sense, but it was, I think, whether intentional or unintentional, part on our director, the guy who played Buckingham also played Richmond. And it's a really interesting double casting, because Buckingham does have a bit of that, you know, Richmond. You can see him as this great leader, and he's extremely smooth and intelligent. And when it comes down to it, he won't kill children. That's pretty good. But he is also corrupt enough to prop up Richard because he thinks that he will greatly benefit by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a wonderful character, and all the Buckinghams are good. Olivier's Buckingham, I wasn't as impressed the first time I watched, but watching it now, I actually really like it.
It's fine. The role got cut significantly. You lose a lot with that, but he was fine.
They all the Richard the Thirds have to like struggle a little bit with explaining what brings the divide. Although I do feel like his pausing at the idea of executing the princes and also not getting his lands is pretty clear cut for why Buckingham decides, like, yep, I'm out. But again, I understand the choice. But in the Olivier one, like, the fun little touch they do direct staging wise is that Olivier forces Buckingham to not only kiss his hand, but kneel right after he's been made king, which like weirds out Buckingham. He's like, what? Like, okay.
You have to wonder if that was just improv. Olivier going on his own power trip. That'd be fun.
Oh, gosh.
But it is, and it's such a turning point in a sense. Him getting rid of Buckingham is the point of no return. Because as you mentioned before, he killed Hastings, he ordered the death of Clarence, but whatever. They're evil. This is the last, Buckingham is the last shred of Richard's humanity. And in a sense, Buckingham always represented Richard's human side, for lack of a better word. And I think that,
well, he's his other self.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. And, oh, also I do love how Olivier also bring back him a little bit more, just how much he plays up the gay innuendo with that line.
Right.
I was like, he's almost flirting with him in that moment. Like, what? He's your cousin, man. I thought, but anyways. But I also want to bring up, again, continuity of how that makes so many lines feel so much richer of the great scene of, and just the repartee of, I know why it has to be cut down, because it's a 4-hour play, for goodness sakes, but to get the full length version of Elizabeth and Richard talking,
yes,
in the attempted wooing, and how it doesn't play compared to the Anne Neville scene, and the psychological games and all the excuses he can come up with. And I guess also I should say, like, Ron Cook's Richard doesn't feel as brilliant and devious or charismatic as the other Richards. And that's what I like about it, is he's much more just, he's just a guy.
I agree. He's also, and I don't mean this, although he probably is, but he's also the youngest. Or he feels the youngest. He might not be in terms of actual age. I never actually went and looked. But he feels the youngest out of them. Like, he is the almost child that he's supposed to be historically.
Yep.
And I think that does come across in how both he's treated by people and how he treats them. I'll still maintain that McKellen's is the most realistic. But yeah, Ron Cook as well, especially compared to Olivier and Cumberbatch. Yeah, he is very much just a guy, and the people who respect him and follow him, you know, the Catesby, Radcliffe, Buckingham, you get a better sense from the Howl version that they're out for their own selves rather than they really believe in this charismatic guy who they should be king. You know, with McKellen, it's like Buckingham believes McKellen is the guy to be king, and that's the right thing to do, essentially. No, Buckingham is, I want this land. Catesby is whatever Catesby wants. We never get that. But everyone is out for themselves because Ron Cook's Richard isn't a noble figure. He isn't a strong leader in any way. He is, in a sense, the weakest of the four Richards for that. And yeah, that's what makes him a better Richard than the other three.
And so, touching a little bit on, again, the complexity of the Hastings scene, I think that that version of the scene also is the best to emphasize, although the Olivier does a decent job with this too, of just emphasizing how much, just like Hastings, right before he dies, and full disclosure, when I read this for one of our Shakespeare groups, that scene, I had Hastings laugh a bit of a dark chuckle when he laughs at the idea of the Woodvilles dying. Of just how much he just doesn't care that the Woodvilles are dying. So he also has his own strange karma of, like, you're not a good person because, like, you totally are fine with these innocent people dying.
Yeah.
Just because, like, you don't like them.
And also, you get the sense that they died because of Hastings. This was Richard's favor to Hastings. Not really, but that's how Richard plays it. So, in a sense, Hastings is gloating at his success, and then he's immediately killed off.
Yeah.
And I said this on the top. Sorry, go on.
And so, no, I understand, like, your complaint of, like, how it seems like it grinds the third act to a halt, and I understand, but just, again, like, in the great thing of just, like, that illusion of being untouchable, and just wishing the downfall of others, and, like, you're only alive because we need, no, will you be on our side? And I was like, no. Then bye-bye.
That is fair. And my problem with Hastings isn't that the scenes themselves don't work out. It's that I do wish it was set up better. And this is, you can't even go back to the earlier bits because his part in Henry the Sixth Part Three is nothing. We don't, he's in one scene and you don't really get anything out of it. In a sense,
He's there.
In my ideal rewriting of Richard III as a solo play, I would actually basically cut Clarence and use that time for Hastings. And that requires a lot of reworking.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what the play needs. I think Hastings needs to be more of a character rather than kind of refer his beef with the Woodville's referred to a bunch, and then he's killed off.
Well, I mean, but Clarence was dead in real life during most of the time depicted, so...
Yeah, I think there is a way to do it. Maybe one day I'll try.
Oh, and also, for the record, again, just Tudor propaganda, but absolutely Edward IV ordered George's death, because George kind of had it coming, because he still couldn't help himself being treacherous and being stupid.
Well, that's the other part, and I can't remember which productions keep it or cut it, but the fact that George dies because of a witch, so is some witch told Edward he'll be betrayed by G, and therefore George has to die. And this, you mentioned before, you know, Macbeth is the supernatural version of Richard III. Now, Richard III has enough supernatural elements powering through it that you get the sense that, yeah, this is, it's almost like, look how superstitious and dumb people were 100 years ago. Isn't that crazy?
The supernatural is so much more on the what does it actually do theoretically. And granted, even the witches, like, all they do is just give this knowledge of the future to Macbeth, and that forever screws him up. But, well, they tell him that he'll be king, and like that.
But doesn't he only become king because they tell him so?
Exactly.
This is my thing with witches. The witches aren't supernatural at all. They just have good news sources and can tell the present
and the future themselves. But the curse is a bit more nebulous from Margaret, and from what you can tell, the only thing that really supernatural happens from Cecily cursing her son is that he has nightmares the night before the battle.
Yes.
But that can also be read as his conscience finally coming up to him.
No, you're absolutely right. The supernatural is far more nebulous. I mean, even the ghosts don't play out the same way that the ghosts of Caesar or Hamlet do, or Macbeth, Banquo, rather. They, you can easily write both of those scenes off as bad dream, good dream type of thing.
And like, even when Ray, Vaughn, and Rivers like say like, gosh, Margaret's curse got to us, that's still like, is it a curse or just like the circumstances and Richard?
Yeah, exactly. And, same with Buckingham.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I was going earlier for when we got a bit on that tangent of Richard just being a dude, but in Ron Cook's portrayal, but again, continuity and just the power of the line is like, oh, I didn't know that was a line, or I didn't remember that was a line, but wow, that has so much more power, is when Elizabeth is saying like that her daughter will never be attracted to Richard. She references the bloody napkin. Like, present her with a bloody napkin, and that actually does throw off Richard, and he does look guilty at that reference. And like, oh, wow. What? Have I become Clifford? Have I become Margaret? Oh, my gosh.
You're reading into that. I know. I think that's a bit of a stretch, to be honest.
Well, just look at that scene and like, look at that line that she gives. Like, that does put him back. Just like when he sees Margaret earlier and the references to Rutland, that's when he like perks up and is actually very still like the Henry VI part 3 Richard of just like, you are so monstrous for what you did to my brother and my father. You are not a good person, Margaret of Anjou. So shut up and get out of here. So.
No, I mean, like I said, I'm not discounting the fact that Howell is clearly presenting this Richard as part of the cycle, and I think it works out very well. More so than Cumberbatch, we do get the full through line with this Richard. Because in part 2 and beginning of part 3, he was very likable.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Howell does his transformation, and then we get this side. And of course, you know, Ron Cook playing it has all of that to work with. So I'm not going to, you know, pretend like there's no merit to seeing it in the cycle. There absolutely is.
Okay, well, that's me and my own interpretation. So And okay, lastly, we should mention though, the actor who played the Dukes of Somerset 1 and 2 plays Richmond.
Oh yeah.
And he also has a Welsh accent. So, just going for it, further Richmond. And the one death we get is the death of Richard on screen. And maybe we should mention, like, how do you feel, or just in general, the ghost scene in Richard the Third is one of the best examples I can ever think of, a scene that reads terrible on the page if you read it, but when played is like so powerful.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that to me the ghost scene is Richard III's version of the son who killed his father, father who killed his son, or I don't know, the Simcox scene from part two, in that, or the War of the Roses bit from part one. It's that one scene that's just, okay, here's the lesson, kids. You know, it's the let's hit you over the head with it. I approve of other versions that cut it down a bit. I think it's a bit of a ridiculous scene. Now, when staged, I think it works far better on stage than on film. And I mean, you can say a lot of things work better visually than on paper. I don't know if this particular any more than most things in Shakespeare. But when you have it staged and you actually have the ghosts like moving, you can see them physically moving between Richard and Richmond, and Howell kind of sort of recreates that a bit. But ridiculous scene.
I disagree. I'm just like, it's so powerful to just, it's you get the death toll suddenly like personified and reminded of just like, oh wow. Wow, you have killed a lot of people in just this play, and also in the other plays, because we get Henry VI.
No, don't get me wrong. I think that the ghosts appearing to Richard are good. It's the Richmond part I bulk at.
Okay, that's why pretty much all the films take that part out.
Exactly.
But I think Howell makes it work because every time that happens, it's Richard looking on as other people are saying that to him.
Yes.
So the twofold punch. It's one's like despair and die, and then also I'm rooting for you, Richmond. Just like, what? No.
Yeah. Now, Howell definitely tries to play it as if it were staged, and she does a decent job, but I still maintain this is as ridiculous as the son who killed his father, father who killed his son, so is the Richard Richmond dream sequence. I know it exists. It's not the worst thing that ever, but
I can see it being heavy-handed and obvious, but I feel that one works much more.
Yes, absolutely. It does. No arguments there.
Yeah. And so,
I don't know, I wish that Richmond is one of the least interesting characters in Shakespeare, like as a, not a main character by any means, but as an important character. And that's obvious, Tudor propaganda.
Yep.
I just wish, you know, by this point, you can take him down a peg, find a way to do a bastard Richmond. Somebody needs to take him down a bit. He's too good.
Well, I'll work on my adaptation and I'll show you what the one idea I have is just have him say a horse or horse, my kingdom for a horse. Just because he was trying to run away from Richard when he was surrounded by Stanley's forces and die, and then Richard was killed.
Yeah.
Like, in the real Bosworth, like Richmond was bravely fighting from the back, and Richard saw him and like charged and was ambushed and killed. So how smart was Richard? Debatable then, yeah, but he was trying to do that more traditional, heroic, medieval thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also great idea and image that all of Richmond's words are heard, but the focus is on Richard's body. As that's
yes. Happening. Yeah.
So we don't really follow and focus on Richmond. We just focus on the death. And then the final image, the best image to end both Richard III and this York tetralogy.
Yeah, and this is where the Holocron loses points, because they steal it and make it worse. So at the very, because, well, two reasons. So in the Margaret, in Margaret's final scene in 4.3, I don't remember the exact line, but she basically says, I'm going to go back to France and laugh at all of you.
Yeah.
And then, so it ends, you know, Richmond finishes his lines, everyone say amen, pan over pile of corpses, and Margaret is just sitting there laughing. And it is just this chilling way to end this like 12-hour marathon type of thing. That is the cycle.
All this civil war, this is all it ended on. And just for someone who might be of the Christian persuasion, of just that the Pietà, the image of Jesus' corpse being held by Mary, just the reverse of that.
Oh, yeah.
Of Margaret being on a mountain of corpses holding the body of Richard. That's ominous.
Yeah. And so what Holocron does is not only cut the Margaret line of, I'm going back to France to laugh at you, but then just has this kind of like more solemn.
Yeah.
You know, what we're supposed to feel bad for her. It was hard to get what, you know, like, okay, everyone's dead except Margaret, I guess. It was very hard to see why they did it beyond the fact that somebody saw Howell's production and thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
But no, that laughter.
That's so chilling.
As the credits start, so yeah. Good.
Well, that's a finale. That's a finale.
Oh, yeah.
And with that, it's not exactly a cheery note to end on, but that's the end. Well, no version of... Only, I would say, Olivier ends on, like, as close to a happy ending as you can get with Richard III.
McKellen's is supposed to be. I think that's what they're going for with that shot. It's like everything ended the way it's supposed to end, type of thing.
Yeah, but I guess.
I guess not calling it happy. No, it's a dour play, and even like for all my Richmond hating and you know the Tudor propaganda, the fact that the original text ends triumphantly. I don't think you're supposed to feel good coming out of it. I think it has more of that, like, King Lear style ending. It's like, well, this sucks. Let's go home.
I think the end, people, at least for the Elizabethan audience, like, wow, thank goodness we won't have another civil war. And thank goodness that time's over. And wait a minute, Elizabeth.
Yes, except they thought they would. Like there was that.
I mean, like that's the fear. It's that like they would. That's kind of like it's like, well, no, like that's the joking like conclusion. Like you walk out, it's like, thank goodness we won't have another civil war. Wait a minute, Elizabeth doesn't have an heir. Oh crap.
Yeah.
And like at the same time, it's like, yay, those Tudors ended those civil wars. Wait a minute. And I think that was Shakespeare's intent. Not that he was trying to rub Queen Elizabeth wrong, but just like that was the thing everyone was worried about. So
it's actually funny. If you look at, and this is worth doing, go to the final moment of at least the 8 major history plays, because I don't remember the final, even King John, the final moment of all of the plays are quite ominous. Really, the only one that ends even triumphantly, Richard III and Henry VI Part II, but those are also tainted with these shadows. Shakespeare didn't leave you on a good note when he wrote a history play.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think. Maybe you could make the case for Henry IV Part I, but...
Yeah, well, Henry IV is dying, but that's the final moment of the play. Hey, we kind of won, except we still have enemies who are coming after us, and I'm dying. The end.
Yeah.
Henry the Fourth Part Two is all right. I guess got to go kill people in France now.
I mean, that would be like more the traditional, but just like after we've just seen Falstaff get carted away, it's so sad.
There is that, yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, no, none of them have happy endings.
Yeah, maybe a good lesson for everyone who seeks power for power's sake.
Sure. Except for Henry VIII, which is Queen Elizabeth being born. Yeah, it's pretty happy.
Yeah, I'm sure that was how people reacted at the time. Yeah. Alrighty. Been so wonderful to have you talk about all these. This has been great.
Yeah, it's cool that we were able to do all four.
Yeah.
For anyone listening, right, go watch Howl's version.
Yes. Yes. 4 amazing hours. Okay.
Oh, it's 12 hours. More than that, actually.
13 hours, yeah.
I love that, yeah.
Alrighty. Been great talking to you. Hopefully you'll come back for something a bit easier.
Sure.
See you then. Bye.
Bye.